Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Unobscured, a production of iHeartRadio and Aaron Menke.
Dr. Joshua Sanborn is a historian of Russia in the 20th century. And if you want to understand World War I from a Russian perspective, you simply can't miss his books. If you've listened through this season of Unobscured, you already know what an expert he is on imperial state politics and the nasty mess the royal family found themselves in. But Dr. Sanborn's books and his conversation with this season's writer Carl Nellis cover so much more than that. His scholarship is a deep exploration of the connections between war and politics in the Romanov Empire and the way that the bloodshed rippled out across all of Russian society, from high to low. So it's a pleasure to offer you this conversation. But strap in, because this train moves at 100 miles an hour, and we're headed for the Eastern Front of the Great War. This is the Unobscured interview series for Season 4. I'm Aaron Menke.
For Unobscured Podcast, I'm Carl Nellis, and I'm joined today by Dr. Joshua Sanborn. Dr. Sanborn is professor of history at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. He has been recognized with numerous awards for his teaching and scholarship, including a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities. In 2003, he published Drafting the Russian Nation, Military Conscription, Total War, and Mass Politics, from 1905 to 1925. And more recently, he published Imperial Apocalypse, The Great War and the Destruction of the Russian Empire with Oxford University Press. Dr. Sanborn is fantastic. His writing is great. I hope you go out and check out his books if you're interested in really digging into the history of this period. It's fantastic to have you join us on Unobscured. Dr. Sanborn, welcome.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So let's start kind of from that general picture of your work, maybe with Imperial Apocalypse in particular, that you've written a fascinating book here on the internal dynamics of the late Russian Empire, especially the significance of the resistance to Russian control in the border countries, but all the ramifications of that as well. Can you say a few things about what brought you to this work in particular?
Sure. Yeah. As with many scholarly careers, it sort of follows a certain kind of trajectory. I got interested in Russia and in Russian history actually back in high school. I grew up at the very end of the Cold War. I was very interested in what was happening in terms of arms control, disarmament. I was very concerned about the way the world was headed and the possibility of nuclear war between the two superpowers. I was firmly convinced that better relations between the two countries were necessary. By the time I graduated college in 1991, the Soviet Union was ending. And so when I was in graduate school in the middle of the 1990s, that same conflict wasn't present, but I certainly had already caught the Russia bug. And I did have this interest in thinking about security and thinking about military affairs, not from the perspective of a military practitioner, of an officer or people that work in the Defense Department, say, but from the perspective of someone that wanted to look at military affairs through a broader lens, through social, political, or cultural lenses. So that's how I got onto the topic of military conscription. I have chapters in there not only about conscription itself, but also about women and women soldiers in World War I, about draft resistors and conscientious objectors. It allowed me to sort of think about a lot of the ways that nationhood was constructed through the performance of violence. And so that was what that book was about. And one of the things, as I was doing the research for that book, I realized that there was a real opening and a real potential to write a book about World War I. The centennial of World War I was coming up. I published this book on the 100th anniversary of the start of the war. And there were other historians, many other historians who were also developing projects at this time. And I began this project as sort of an investigation of life in frontline zones. I was really interested in the civilian experience. What happened to civilians that were living in these occupied territories who were subject to deportations, millions of whom became refugees, were tossed back and forth between these empires, and had this really interesting political experience as nationalism really sort of grew in the period too. And so I moved from that to a larger conception of the war, not just of as a lived experience, but also as this moment of decolonization, this moment where European empires were collapsing. The big land empires were collapsing, the German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and the Russian Empire. And what relationship did the war have to that? In other words, was it just sort of the final blow, or was it something more more substantial? And so that was what was beginning to govern the way I then structured and wrote the book.
And if someone who is not a historian or is not a specialist was to pick up Imperial Apocalypse, what would you hope that they would take away from reading it? So if that was the idea coming in, mm-hmm. what did you discover? What would you hope that a reader would come away thinking about the relationship between the end of European empires mm-hmm. and world?
Yeah. So in the first place, it was an attempt to give especially English language readers the possibility to learn more about what the war looked like from the Eastern Front. There have been many works actually written on the Eastern Front, but most of the ones that sort of had an ability to sort of look at the thing in the whole, many of those were quite dated back to the 1970s. And the archives had opened since then. There were a lot of new ways about thinking about Russian politics and the Russian Revolution. And so this is a relatively compact way for them to get to know what's going on the Eastern Front. So I talk about the political things that are going on. I talk about these social experiences, but I also talk about the military events. And all of these are tightly linked, as I try to show in the book, that you can't actually understand what's happening on the front without understanding what's happening in the home front and vice versa. So that's the first thing, this sort of compact understanding of the Eastern Front in World War I. And the second thing is to understand this relationship between empires, wars, and revolutions. Empires are not just big states. They're states that are built around the principle of inequality, right? One political society is dominating other ones. And the metropolitan centers are privileged, whether you're in London or in St. Petersburg. And the colonial spaces are dominated, right? Whether you're in Ireland or in Poland, right? Those are places that you are not, sort of experiencing equality in the years building up to 1914. And this domination is enacted by the state. And so when wars weaken states, as they sometimes do, and they definitely did in Eastern Europe at this time, you get opportunities for different kinds of political futures, including social revolutions, which we see in the period, but also nationalist bids for independence.
Would you briefly describe the role in that imperial context that autocracy played in Russian life? And maybe in Russian life and consciousness, or kind of a cultural history approach to it, at the end of the 1800s into the early 1900s, how would you characterize the relationship between the czars and the people they ruled? And this is a little curveball, maybe mm-hmm. on the question that I handed you, mm-hmm. but would you want to make a distinction between the relationship between the czars and the people in the center of Russia and the mm-hmm. czars and the people elsewhere?
Yeah. No, this is a surprisingly difficult question to answer, actually. It's hard to know what the relationship between the Tsar and the people were. In large part, if you were right, there are no surveys, there are no polls, there's no way to really get at this question. And so much of what we have is the representation of the autocracy itself for how it wanted that relationship to be, how it wanted it to look. And they had a lot of resources in order to sort of have that happen. Indeed, in the years building up to World War I, there are a series of celebrations that sort of they heightened this. They were intended to heighten this bond between the monarch and the people, and these build up to the tercentenary, the 300th anniversary of the Romanov dynasty itself, in 1913. And so they have big celebrations that always are trying to stress this bond between the Tsar and the people. And generations actually of historians have sort of accepted this in a lot of ways, have accepted this notion that, yeah, there was this thing called, popular monarchism, where the peasants, they loved the Tsar. They might not like their landlord, but they loved their Tsar. The Tsar represented Russia for them. there's just not a lot of evidence to support that. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest that it wasn't there either, other than what actually ends up happening in the war. And so my argument ultimately is that, you know, when you see this revolt against the Tsar, you start to get these signals, and indeed these had been building for years, that that peasants who, the farmers, Russian farmers throughout the empire, are not satisfied with the Tsar, do not look at him as a little god, do not look at him as their little father. And so, you know, it's kind of hard to know that. Now, the relationship between the Tsar and ethnic Russians and those on the periphery, that is certainly different. And that's going to vary widely depending on where in the Russian Empire you are. So nationalism and anti-Russian nationalism is developing more strongly in certain places than in others, most notably in Poland, but also beginning to develop by the time we get to the 20th century in places like Ukraine and in the Baltic states, and even to a certain extent, more broadly into sort of the Asian territories of the Russian Empire too. And I guess, you know, just finally, I guess if I were to characterize this relationship, I think the thing we have to remember is that this relationship is distant. The Tsar always wanted to see this as an intimate relationship, but it was a distant one. You know, most people, of course, never saw the Tsar. And, you know, they lived their lives in their local regions, in these local contexts, and the Tsar was something that was very far away and had, and they thought had very little impact probably on their lives.
One movement in the prelude to the collapse of the Russian Empire was the process called Russification or Russianization. You write that it entailed assaults on churches, language, schools, at the precise moment when the great reforms from the 1860s were creating conditions in which the social basis of nationalism could develop. Would you give us kind of a brief overview of Russification? Its relationship to nationalism, maybe, and especially beyond the metropole of the Russian Empire.
Yeah, sure. The first thing we have to keep in mind is that the Russian Empire was created before nations were born, including the Russian nation. So nationalism is a fairly late development historically, not just in Russia, but everywhere. We can see its early growth among elite educated populations in the 17th and 18th century, but it's not really until the late 18th century, and especially in the 19th century, that it begins to take off in Europe and the Americas. And of course, the Romanov dynasty had been founded in the 17th century. And in the 19th century, it's at the same time that we're seeing not only the great reforms in Russia, which are intended to sort of create a more modern empire, but we see mass industrialization. We see the beginning of mass politics in Russia, and certainly its wide expansion elsewhere in Europe. We see mass education take root, huge strides in literacy and the ability of people to be reading newspaper articles about what's going on. Now, the political power of nationalism, including its ability to mobilize much stronger armed forces, was evident quite quickly to politicians. And so you have all of these pre-national multi-ethnic states, the Habsburg Empire, the Romanov dynasty, the Ottoman Empire, all of them are trying to nationalize themselves over the course of the 19th century. And so their problem is, in a multi-ethnic state, as all of them are, as Russia certainly is, they either have to figure out how to fashion a multi-ethnic national project, that is to say, a nation that is not founded on a single ethnicity, or to engage in building ethnic nationalism. In fact, Russia tried to do both, but it was this latter project, defending the idea that the Russian Empire was for the benefit of ethnic Russians and could be defined by Russian characteristics in terms of language and church, that caused the problems of Russification. So in concrete terms, what Russification is, it's an attempt to limit, let's say, Polish participation in politics, to forbid the publishing of Ukrainian language texts, to ensure that local schools, these new schools that are building, are being taught in Russian with a Russian with Russian curriculum, basically, right? So that's on a concrete level what's happening is they're going into these regions and saying, no, you have to go to a Russian language school. No, the Orthodox Church is the preferred church, not Catholicism or Lutheranism, as it is for many of the populations, especially in the west of the empire, or Islam in large swaths of Asia. They're going into all these regions and they're saying, no, Russian, this is the Russian Empire, and you have to learn Russianness. And you can see why imperial administrators might want to say, okay, well, look, Ukrainian nationalism is a problem we have to figure out. Let's solve it by by teaching all these Ukrainian kids Russian history and the Russian language, and maybe we'll sort of forestall it. But in fact, it was the opposite that took place. At the very moment, like people before the 19th century didn't think of themselves as Ukrainians. They didn't think of themselves as Russians. They thought of themselves as peasants or as Christians, but they didn't have these strong ethnic identifications that linked them to these political projects. So at the very moment they're learning about this, the earliest political experiences is one of imperial oppression, basically. And so this helps to generate these ethnic nationalists on the periphery. They had long tried to say, hey, you guys are all Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians would be like, I don't know, I'm kind of a peasant. I'm kind of a Christian. And now they're coming along and now they finally have the proof. They're like, see, you're Ukrainians. The state is punishing you for being a Ukrainian. Now they say, oh yeah, now I see what you mean. Like, I can't go to the church I want to go to. My kids are speaking some weird language when they come home from school with a weird accent, right? Like all of that becomes much more concrete for them. And so as a result, Russification, which is intended to limit the spread of ethnic nationalism, actually helps to develop it, especially in these Western borderlands, Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. This is where a lot of the Russification is happening and where you see this huge surge in nationalism at the end of the 19th century.
And you write, this is later on in your work, especially in 1916, about events in Central Asia. Mm-hmm. Do we know much about how Siberia experienced Russification?
So Siberia is an interesting case. And, you know, what had happened over the course of conquest in Siberia from the 16th into the 17th centuries, basically, is that there had been especially in the north, the further north you went, they tended to be very small communities that got conquered and sort of incorporated into the Russian Empire and also settled by ethnic Slavs. Again, there wasn't a strong sense of, there were a lot of sort of people we would now call ethnic Ukrainians who are doing this colonizing work out in Siberia and elsewhere. The more you got on the big rivers in Siberia and especially down towards Central Asia, you had more a large scale and settled Muslim communities, the remnants of the Mongol Empire, basically. And those were places where they had a much more complicated time sort of dealing with this question of Russianness. And honestly, especially from the early 19th century, the goal over the centuries of the Russian administration was, let's not do things to make people upset. We don't have a rebellion. So if people want to go to their own church, fine. Who cares if Muslims go to a mosque? We're not going to force them to go to an Orthodox church. They can go to a mosque. As long as they're paying taxes and they're not rebelling, you know, and their elites are basically on board, we're fine with all of this. And so it's only in the 19th century, again, that you start to see these pressures towards greater assimilation in a certain way. And this is more possible for the ones that are closer to or conceived of as more possible for those who are closer to the Russian Empire and had been conquered much earlier, especially along the Volga, the so-called Tatars, along the Volga River, than it is for the newly conquered territories in the middle of the 19th century in what's called Turkestan at the time, which now Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, parts of Kyrgyzstan. So this region is newly conquered, and this is a very special, it's a colonial territory. It's treated as the British would treat a colony in Africa or in Asia.
So starting to look in a little more detail toward war and revolution and war and revolution again, would you say a few words about how the 1904 Russo-Japanese War and the revolution of 1905, well, in your book, you say it transformed the international balance of power. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, when we're talking about World War I, when we're talking about the downfall of Russia, we have to understand the Russo-Japanese War and what changed in Russian life and governance in 1905. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how those things were linked and what happened beyond the borders then of Russia?
Right. Yeah, so the Russo-Japanese War happens at a very, let me start with the international question first. It happens at a very volatile moment internationally. You're in the midst of this huge arms race, which is going to culminate in World War I. The rise of new powers challenging sort of the preeminence, let's say, especially of the British Empire. The story of sort of the German challenge to the British Empire is well known, and we're fully in the midst of that by 1904 and 1905. But also you're seeing emerging powers elsewhere in the world, most notably Japan, which is striving to be sort of the first non-European member of the Club of Great Powers. At this stage, they're not quite there. They have established dominance in East Asia. That in 1895, they won a war against China, and the Qing Empire is certainly in the midst of fading, on the verge of collapse, which we'll do in a couple of years. And so Japan is clearly the most significant power, and they want to be recognized as such. And what happens as China becomes a target of global imperial control, you start to have the push for concessions, not only among the British, who had had concessions for a while, but also among the Russians. The Americans now are trying to take part in this scramble for China. Japan is really trying to assert itself as a regional power and hopefully as a global power, and this the European powers are generally unwilling to do this, and Russia is for a variety of reasons especially unwilling to do this. And part of this has to do with Nicholas himself. He had done a tour before he became Tsar, when he had Tsarevich into Asia, had traveled through Japan, held a series of quite openly racist views towards the Japanese, and did not want to think about the Japanese as a potential imperial threat to Russian imperial power. And this leads to a series of diplomatic incidents, and then finally to a surprise attack by the Japanese in 1904 upon the Russian Pacific Fleet in Port Arthur. And this results in a disastrous war for Russia. They have three main naval fleets in the Pacific, in the Baltic, and in the Black Sea. They lose two of them. The third one is bottled up in the Black Sea because they can't get through the straits. But their Pacific fleet is sunk basically at the beginning of the war. They send their Baltic fleet all the way around the world. The Japanese sink it too in the Straits of Tsushima. And they lose all the major land battles. And so it's a complete disaster. And what it triggers is this mass mobilization, not only for the military, but also a kind of a political mobilization at the same moment you have a political crisis in 1905. So it leads to helps lead to revolutionary events. Those have also, social revolution has been developing on its own track basically in Russia at the same time from the 1860s onward. And so you have the culmination of this political mobilization around social issues, especially with the rise of important Marxist parties. But also you have this international crisis, and this all explodes in this massive revolution in 1905, which leads to very famous events, one called Bloody Sunday in January of 1905, in which peaceful protesters are shot by palace guards, basically at the command of the Tsar, and it leads very nearly to the to the end of the Romanov dynasty in 1905. And it's only because of the efforts of especially competent conservatives, especially one named Sergei Witte, who both signs the peace treaty, gets out of the war with Japan in the summer of 1905, and also convinces the Tsar to sign a new basically set of agreements with society that allows for the formation of a parliament that begins. Sends Russia down the road toward potentially a constitutional monarchy. It's only that basically cools things off in the fall of 1905. And once sort of the moderate and liberal opposition is appeased by these constitutional quasi-constitutional measures, then they can go after the left wing in earnestness. And this is what Pyotr Stolypin, who will eventually become prime minister, becomes famous for, is sort of helping to lead this repression against left wing groups who do not want to see peace in 1905.
Within Russia, you write that year and those events that you just talked about flipped a switch in Russian politics. And you've started to describe a little bit about what those things were. Could you just give a little bit more of a sense, maybe from the lived perspective or mm-hmm. however you want to take it, what it felt like to live in Russia at that time before the establishment of the Duma and then after? Obviously, like you said, Nicholas and the government felt like they were making huge concessions, and maybe there were others who experienced a big shift. Mm-hmm. What did it feel like?
It's a very important moment because look, the Romanov dynasty and the Tsarist autocracy, These were non-mobilizational conservative regimes. That is to say, they did not want people, even their supporters, out on the streets, right? Their idea of what a public should do is that it should be quiet and satisfied. They did not want large numbers of people out on the streets organizing for them. They didn't want political parties, even right-wing political parties. And the early right-wing political parties, the monarchist parties that form in Russia are almost, they say in sort of the organizing documents, we wish we didn't have to be a party, but now that we have a parliament, we sort of have to play this game. And this is very important to understand because it's so different from 20th century politics, right? There are plenty of military dictatorships and especially fascist dictatorships that rely on public mobilization, right? That have these big, you know, torchlight rallies. I mean, you think about what Hitler's doing in the 30s. I mean, it would have made Nicholas's skin crawl to think of all those people out there being mobilized for political ends. That's not what, you know, the only way he wanted them, as we used to see at the beginning of the war, is sort of praying with him at a moment and then saying, go do your thing, right? So that's his vision of politics, is that power comes from him and he gives it to other people, not that it flows up from the streets, not that it flows up and he's sort of part of that mobilizational process. And so they had consistently tried to thwart that mobilization. So what we see when we see in 1905 that we see actually revolutionary activities, many, many cities in the Russian Empire, you have these mass demonstrations, you have pitched battles between revolutionaries and policemen. You have large meetings pressing for constitutional change. You have people talking about elections and political parties and you know, recruiting people, all that stuff. It's just a different mode of politics. It's modern politics. It's mobilizational politics. And that's completely different from what the Tsars had tried to have over the previous, you know, not only the previous 300 years, but going back even further, of course. So that's the switch that gets flipped. Now we're in an era of mobilizational politics, and that's really going to inform what happens in World War I, because immediately upon the declaration of war, most of the Tsar's people, led by military men who had been pushing for a mobilizational structure for years, for reasons I can go into if you'd like, but they had really wanted this sort of active mobilization and enthusiasm on the part of the population. Now when war gets declared in 1914, they say, great, let's mobilize. We need to mobilize everybody. And so this old autocratic dream of just sort of controlling things from above is fundamentally destroyed in the very first day of the war. And the last person to come to realize this actually is Nicholas himself. And that's one of the things that leads to the problems at the end of the regime.
So you mentioned that one of the things that happens here is the establishment of the parliament, the Duma. Could you talk a little bit about what it was? How did it work? What's the Duma when it gets set up?
Yeah, it's a very troubled early history in particular, because, again, you know, not only Nicholas, but many in the administration sort of have this belief that at heart, most people want to be good subjects of the Tsar. They're going to want to vote for parties that are supportive of them, that the people are behind them. In other words, that's what they want to believe. And there's just all these rabble-rousing revolutionaries out there. There's a lot of anti-Semitism. So they're saying, oh, all these rabble-rousing Jewish revolutionaries out there. And once the true Russian people have their voice, you know, they're going to vote for us. They're still a little worried about it. They don't like city dwellers very much. And so they create this system in which more power is given basically to rural areas, and those rural areas are also dominated by the nobility, by landowners. It's not one person, one vote. You vote in a certain curia in which, you know, let's say the peasants in a region get one representative and the nobles in a region get one representative. Well, you know, there's, you know, 95% peasants and 5% nobles. And so it's not an equal sort of relationship there. And so you end up with many, many more nobles. And there's also an upper house of parliament that is half of it is appointed by the Tsar and the other half is based on sort of jobs that are also basically highly sort of Tsarist driven. So a guaranteed conservative upper house and pro-monarchist upper house as well. With all of that said, they get the first Duma elections and the people vote for moderate or left-wing parties overwhelmingly. And you have this huge conflict over basic things like land reform. And land reform obviously is just sort of code for saying we're going to take the land from the landowners and give it to the peasants that are working it. So the landowners hate that idea, but the Duma wants to do it. So they disband the first Duma. The second Duma, they do the same thing. It doesn't get much better, even though they try to ban many of the parties this time in the second Duma. And that also doesn't work. And so it's only with the third Duma, and this again is something that Pyotr Stolypin accomplishes in 1907, He says, okay, we're going to switch this, the electoral system, even more. We're going to weight it even more in favor of people that we know are going to vote for us. And then they get, even then, you know, it's sort of a moderate system, sort of it's moderates that are at the heart of that system. And left-wing parties are almost complete, but not completely, but almost completely marginalized. And right-wing parties get much more voice in both the third and the fourth Dumas. And those, again, are going to last all the way. The fourth Duma is the one that is going to be in place throughout the war.
Well, and this speaks really to what you were saying earlier about not knowing what the people actually thought of the Tsar. That when you finally get elections, the Duma ends up looking like people who want to take land away from the established country.
Yeah, 100%. When you ask people, do you want rich people to continue to run the land, or do you want to farm your own land? It's not unclear what they're going to vote for. So they're definitely anti-monarchist at that point.
Let's talk a little bit more about Stolypin.
Mm-hmm.
You and other historians have talked about him as mm-hmm. the most important political figure of this period. Who was he, and what was his role in governing the Russian Empire at this point?
Yeah, I mean, Stolypin is a really interesting figure. A lot of people end up becoming bureaucrats over the course of the Russian Empire of varying levels of talent, because this was not, no system is a pure meritocracy, but the Russian imperial bureaucracy definitely wasn't. Connections played a large role. Whether you sucked up to the Tsar enough played a large role. All of these things over time meant that you had quite a hodgepodge of abilities. In that spectrum, Stolypin was unusually talented, unusually competent, and this helped account for his importance in the short period, 4 or 5 years, in which he's prime minister in this quasi-constitutional system. He's assassinated in 1911, and I'll talk about that in just a second. He comes from the imperial borderlands. He has in Lithuania and Belarus, he has positions as he sort of moves around the sort of system by which bureaucrats sort of move from post to post. But he's actually in Russia, in Saratov, in the 1905 revolution, and he again distinguishes himself in 1905, not only by sort of competence, but also his brutality against left-wing revolutionaries. And so it's going to be this mix for him of on the one hand, being sort of a competent bureaucrat, but also his reputation as being especially anti-left-wing and willing to use force against them, that is going to endear him in a certain way to the administration and briefly to the Tsar himself. And this is going to allow him the ability to try to put forward reforms in the period from 1907 to 1911. Which are really quite important ones. Stolypin, at the end of the day, is a Russian nationalist. And nationalism is a mass mobilizational structure of the kind that I talked about before. So Stolypin is trying to figure out how can we incorporate nationalism into this empire, make it more participatory, but also not completely alienate all the non-Russians. It's a really difficult task, but he knows, and he's a modern politician. He solicits interest groups. He makes sure he has their support at various times for particular programs and not others. So, you know, he's trying to play this politics all the time, both with the Duma and with other people within the Tsarist administration. So, for instance, their educational reforms, he's moving towards the idea of universal mass education. His most famous one is an agricultural reform in which he wants to break up the Russian commune and build a system of basically independent family farmers, sort of like the American Midwest in a certain way, and break up the old Russian commune as a way of sort of stimulating agricultural capitalism and strengthening Russians. But he also has a series, especially in Poland, of attempts to make sure that Polish nationalists and also other kinds of nationalists don't get too much power. And so he's always forwarding a Russian nationalist line there. And he's also the author of several military reforms that are also of importance, as he realizes the importance of the growing arms race and the likelihood of a European war in the near future. So Stolypin is doing all of these things. And he has already earned the hatred of the left, but he's also now earning the displeasure of the Tsar and many conservatives, because he is pushing a quite a different system than the one that they are imagining. And he is also running afoul of entrenched interests within the Tsarist bureaucracy, right? These people that get sort of sweetheart deals in terms of state budgets, and he's pushing other budgetary priorities, for instance. And so he begins to be seen as this sort of as an outsider who's causing more trouble than is necessary. And so he's already lost the faith of the Tsar by the time that he's assassinated in Kyiv, at an opera house in Kyiv in 1911. And so there's sort of a sigh of relief, almost an audible sigh of relief from the Tsar when he's assassinated. Not that he wanted to see him assassinated, but there's a sigh of relief because now he can go back to sort of a much more traditional set of prime ministers who are basically just going to be yes men for him, right? That are going to be traditionally sort of subservient in a way. And Stolypa was clearly an independent political force that that made the Tsar nervous.
So you mentioned that Stolypin's attempts not to alienate, you know, non-ethnic Russians, to think about how to keep the periphery functioning without revolution building up. That's contrasted with what Nicholas and Alexander thought of the territories at the center of their vast domain, right? Versus, say, Ukraine and Poland, Siberia, east of the Urals, things westward Europe. If Stolypin was really worried about not alienating people, what did Nicholas and Alexander think? What do we know about how much of a contrast that was with the way the Tsars thought?
Yeah, you know, Nicholas and Alexander didn't want to alienate people either. But again, in this traditional view, people should be loyal subjects of their monarch, regardless of what ethnicity they were. And sort of organizing the monarchy around a national basis was kind of problematic for them in some ways. I mean, in sort of racial terms, ethnic term, which people were increasingly using now by the early 20th century, over the course of the 19th and 20th century, much of the Romanov family was German. You know, virtually all of the Tsars over the course of the 19th century had chosen brides from the German principalities and then from Germany itself. And so many of them had German mothers. And this had been going back for generations. And this was starting to become a problem for them, right? Alexander would eventually be criticized for being pro-German because she had this German background. But it's not the way that earlier dynasties thought. Of course you would marry someone from another. You wouldn't marry one of your own princes or princesses because that would just complicate your domestic affairs. You find royalty or elsewhere. That's where you're going to find your bride if you're the heir to the throne. And so it wasn't a problem, but increasingly it is becoming a problem. And so again, you're seeing this distinction as Nicholas and Alexandra think about Poland and Ukraine. They think, well, the Poles should be grateful to us. We're saving them from the Germans, and the Armenians and the Georgians should be happy that they're not overrun by Turks, and Ukrainians in their view are just sort of Russians with a weird accent, you know, like that. That was sort of their view of the world, and the notion that these that there might be legitimate in certain senses national movements that you had to deal with as a politician in the way that Stolypin was dealing with them was problematic for them. So again, these are, and again, it's not as if Stolypin was giving a lot of concessions. You know, his famous slogan was that you need to build a great Russia. This was going to be a Russian empire with Russianness at its center, but again, with an administrative awareness that other political forces were out there that needed to be dealt with.
You mentioned earlier the tercentenary celebrations for the Romanov. Can you say a few more things about that? What did they think they were doing with that?
Yeah.
How significant did they think it was? But what did they actually signal to the various factions in Russian life at the time, whether we're talking about peasants or administrators or regional, you know, or the people in their court internationally? Mm-hmm. How significant were the tercentenary celebrations to the various parties of it?
Yeah, I think it was an attempt, as I sort of mentioned earlier, is an attempt to have their vision, their narrative of the relationship of the Tsar and the people, one that they believed in themselves, be enacted for them in front of them. And when much of this happened, you know, there's a great article by a historian named Richard Wortman called "Invisible Threads" about these celebrations, in particular about the Tsar's visit to Kostroma, a city not too far from Moscow, in which you have these big celebrations and the nobility welcome you, and there's crowds of cheering peasants. This is exactly what Nicholas wanted to see, and he's able to convince himself that this is the political reality. And so it's dangerous in a certain way, right? When you start using your own product, but he had always sort of used his own product, right? He was always imbuing himself with this notion that he was a popular Russian Tsar, and that Tsars don't get their authority by being voted or surveyed, but it's just this mystical thing. You're born with it, and then the peasants recognize it, and it helps to reinforce that. Now there is Wortman also points out in this article, you know, that there are those that are critical of this and saying, you know, you need to have a more complicated sense of what politics actually looks like if you're going to understand this, because many people are not happy with this. Indeed, some of the nobility boycott the visit. They're not really visible to him at that moment because, you know, there are big problems and sort of having these big parades is not solving them.
And there's a point when King Haakon of Norway, who, of course, was a relative, you know, all those related to each other. This was reported widely in the U.S. press at the time, and I just found it so fascinating that one of his royal relatives was saying, if you want to stave off real trouble, you know, he's thinking revolution, you've got to let Poland have independence. You've got to let the little Russians, you know, Ukraine have independence, and you've got to institute these reforms. How would Nicholas have received something like that? I mean, we kind of know he did nothing along those lines. We kind of know how he received them, but it would be great to have you just say, how would Nicholas have received that from another monarch who's telling him, hey, institute some democratic reforms?
Yeah, you know, this, I mean, it's important to understand that when 1914 comes along, you're already having sort of a early crest of this decolonizing process. You're seeing it already in the Balkans. You know, there are two Balkan wars that precede World War One, and you see the Ottoman Empire being pushed out, not only in favor of other empires, but in favor of new nationalizing states like Serbia and Bulgaria. You're seeing the same thing in Britain. The home rule debate over Ireland is feverish in the months leading up to 1914. And this is the kind of thing that was being proposed. And I think this is what Haakon is saying too, right? Give home rule, not necessarily independence to Poland and Ukraine, but home rule to them and try to make some concessions to have something other than sort of a completely Russian dominated state. Give some voice to your constituents. And this fell on welcome ears, not among the Tsar and his family, but among others in the Russian political system who did see this as, and especially for centrists and left-wing centrists, the Cadet Party, the Constitutional Democratic Party, this was their vision. They're pushing what that would eventually call federalism, a federal solution to empire, which is to say, okay, we realize that people don't like the empire because Russia has dominated all of you. But what if we had a multi-ethnic state in which everybody had sort of regional representation and authority within their own regions, some sort of federal solution. And this becomes the dream of many who don't want to give up on the idea of a large Russian state, but want to acknowledge that there are legitimate political demands by other ethnic groups within the state. And that's kind of the direction that I think Haakon is suggesting. And again, that's not something that Nicholas is inclined to want to do. The difficulty is that Nicholas himself, starting in 1914, begins to play a much larger role in developing ethnopolitics, to encouraging the idea that you should mobilize around your ethnicity. And so he tries to do some of that in the midst of the war as well. So, and this is the toxic combination that explodes over the course of the war.
Could you say a few more words on that toxic combination? Mm-hmm. What's going through and why is it so bad?
Yeah. So the first thing many of these empires do, they're bordering each other, right? Many of them have the same ethnic groups on either side of let's take Ukrainians, for instance. There are Ukrainians in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. There are Ukrainians in the Russian Empire. You know, there are Poles in the German Empire. There are Poles in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. There are Poles in the Russian Empire. So the first thing they think of is, okay, let's leverage this nationalism. Let's try to defeat our enemy by leading to revolution. So we're going to try to encourage Poles in the Russian Empire to push for independence if you're in Germany, and vice versa. The Germans try to convince Islamic leaders all over the world that they need to launch a jihad against the British and Russian empires. That doesn't go anywhere, really. But the idea is, let's stimulate nationalism, ethno-nationalism, as a way of undermining empire. The problem is, of course, you are also in a multi-ethnic empire. And the Poles are also living in Germany. So like, if you're going to have an independent Poland, you're also, and the other side is also doing that, right? So POW camps get aligned around ethnic groups, and you send them back into their countries to try to be subversives. And so all of them mobilize nationalism, and it helps. I mean, nationalism grows immensely over the course of the war, and all of these empires collapse at the end of the war, and they helped it happen because this is the explosive combination. Because they had to mobilize, and because they thought that nationalism was the most powerful mobilizational tool, they encouraged nationalism, which is anti-imperial at its core, and that helps break all these empires apart.
Hmm. Before, you know, on the road to war, you note that Russian politicians wanted to avoid war. You include Nicholas in this, mm-hmm. of course. You even write that he was kind of primary among the people who thought war would be a bad thing. Can you say a little bit about how each of these, you know, maybe different levels of the state, of the mm-hmm. Russian state, Duma, Nicholas, why did they want to avoid war?
Yeah. All of them thought that war was not in their interest, especially in the short term. There's no real lobby for war in the Russian Empire. They're all very aware. Look, we've already discussed 1905. The last war had almost led to the end of the regime. It caused a lot of problems. They all knew that it caused problems. They had a large military expansion plan that was just underway. They were going to be much more strong in 5 years than they were, you know, in 1914. This was one of the reasons, by the way, that Germany wanted to launch war in 1914. It's because they also knew that Russia was going to be much stronger as time went on. So they didn't want any. They didn't want any any part of the war. So the question is, how do they end up in a war that they don't want to see? And this is a very complicated and much studied process called the July Crisis, in the month before the outbreak of the war, all of this wrangling happens. The short answer to this is that Russia believes that if it backs away, if it lets Serbia be conquered basically by Austria-Hungary, then they will have lost their seat at the Club of Great Powers. They're going to have shown fundamental weakness, and they have to show strength. And they knew what happened to empires that fell out of the club. Look what happened to the Ottoman Empire. Look what happened to the Chinese Empire. These are places that are being, you know, colonized and dismembered by the victors. And so you have to remain a member of that great power club. And they convinced themselves that they have to stand firm for Serbia in order to do so. So what they try to do is they try to isolate Austria-Hungary from Germany, right? To say, look, you know, if we can make this conflict between Russia and Austria-Hungary, they're going to have to back down, or we'll beat them one-on-one in a war. We just don't want war with Germany at the same time. So what happens over the course of this process is they want to sort of move from a position of strength. They want to say, look, we're gonna forcefully say we're going to defend them, and that's going to be a deterrent because Germany probably also doesn't want war, and Austria-Hungary can't afford to fight us alone. So we're going to try to divide that alliance. So their early partial mobilization is only mobilization on the border of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Nicholas sends telegrams to Wilhelm saying, look, I don't want war. What can we do to avoid this? And Nicholas personally, again, doesn't want to see this. I think both for just he doesn't much like war, but he also, you know, sees the problems that it can create. But at the end of the day, they say, look, we can't back down at this moment. And we have to mobilize because it's going to take us longer to mobilize than it's going to take Germany to mobilize. So, you know, the logic of the end of this process is that they're going to move towards a general mobilization, which they continue to insist to Germany doesn't have to mean war. We're mobilizing. Just don't invade us. But Germany insists throughout the July crisis, any movement towards mobilization is a declaration of war. Now, many historians after the fact have also accepted that. They've said, look, Russia created the war because they mobilized, but it's not. Mobilization isn't a declaration of war. It's only the Germans said it. That's the only reason that people are taking it as a declaration of war, right? And this gets back to the larger question of why Germany wants war at that particular moment and why Austria-Hungary wants war at that particular moment. And that's, you know, obviously there's been a lot of discussion about that, but that's how Russia goes to war, despite the fact that there's no constituency for it within the Russian political system.
And you've already said a few things about why you refer to World War One in your book as the Third Balkan War. Mm-hmm. Would you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. It certainly begins that way. As I mentioned before, there are two wars that are called the Balkan Wars were the occasion for getting the Ottoman Empire out of the Balkan Peninsula. These happened in 1912 and in 1913. In 1912, you get all of these regions, all these nationalist movements, many of which have support from Russia, being able to push the Ottomans off. So we're looking at, you know, Serbia, greater Serbia. We're looking at Bulgaria, Greece, all of these countries, Macedonia is contested, Montenegro also being a part of this coalition. And they win the war quite quickly against the Ottomans. And this is quite clearly an anti-imperial war. That is to say, it's on the part of nationalist movements. And it's not saying we prefer one empire over another. We're saying that imperial rule as such is something that ought to be contested. So that's why it's kind of a decolonizing war. But as with many decolonizing wars, this just opens up a new question of regional power. And you get these new nation states starting to act like mini empires themselves, most notably Serbia in this case. And this is what causes the Second Balkan War between Serbia and Bulgaria over the question of Macedonia. And so already you see that decolonization isn't an end. In other words, nationalism doesn't just come when the empire leaves. That just opens up the more interesting phase of politics, honestly, and the more violent phase. Frankly, of the politics of decolonization. And so you have these first two Balkan wars. And the third war, as we all know, is triggered in the Balkans, in Sarajevo, with the assassination of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. This is an assassination that is not random. Franz Ferdinand is in Sarajevo to oversee military maneuvers. They have just recently annexed the territory. They had occupied it since 1878, and they just recently formally annexed it in 1908. And you have these young radicals who are inspired both by nationalism, but also by the Russian revolutionary movement, now looking to change the dynamic on the ground. These are not the people that kill Franz Ferdinand are not sponsored by Russia. They're not even sponsored by the top Serbian leadership. They are sponsored by the head of military intelligence, who is trying to run his own sort of radical paramilitary revolutionary movement the same time that he's heading military intelligence. But Serbia has just had two wars in the last 2 years. They're not in any position to fight Austria-Hungary at this point. And so they really drive these events. And it's for that reason that we have this as a Third Balkan War. Christopher Clark, in his well-respected and really great book, Sleepwalkers, talks also about how you have this Balkan inception scenario that develops in France, England, Germany at the same time over the course of 1912 and 1913, by which they begin to expect that war might happen and which side they would take if it did. And so all of these things sort of come together to have this Third Balkan War then metastasize into a broader European war and then, of course, into a world war.
So in the as the Russian army mobilizes and conflict begins, you write that many Russian officers were already inclined to look at the world through ethnic lenses in 1914. And we've talked a bit about that already. But you then say that the war prompted the high command to almost universally deploy an ethnic grid of reliability. Would you say a few words about how ethnic suspicions fed fear of spies and over time motivated violence even against civilian populations, how ethnic, you know, reliability and ethnic lines and divisions became so crucial to Russia during the war and the Russian military?
Yeah, for sure. As I mentioned, they were already well-trained culturally as well as professionally to think of the world in ethnic terms. Virtually all of them were anti-Semitic, that is to say, they held a wide range of beliefs about what Jews believed, what Jews did, and especially how Jews thought about the army. They thought that on the one hand that they were subversive and pro-German, and on the other hand that they were all cowardly draft dodgers. So they had this wide-ranging and very toxic view of Jews in the region. And they believed, not completely unreasonably, that ethnic Germans, there are plenty of ethnic Germans living in the Russian borderlands, were going to be sympathetic to the German armies that were moving in. By the same token, their pan-Slavism inclined them to think that at the end of the day, the Poles would rather be part of Russia than part of Austria-Hungary or Germany. This was not true for the most case, but most of them believed it. And so what they end up doing is, and this was a lot of the archival work I did, was looking through the sort of cases of purported espionage in these frontline zones in the first couple of years of the war. They go through, and counterintelligence agents, they will go through and they'll arrest all of the Jews, they'll deport all the Germans, and then they'll be surprised that there are still spies there because they're the Germans and Austro-Hungarians, they're sending Poles, but they're also just hiring local Russians. They're, you know, like the espionage is not being conducted solely on ethnic terms, but that's the sort of grid of reliability that I'm talking about here. So when the Russian army moves into these territories, and remember, many of these territories are on the Russian side of the border, but you now have this massive amount of troops coming in there, and they need to requisition goods, they need to make sure there's no rebellions, they need to make sure there's no espionage, they start basically engaging in ethnopolitics. And this ranges from, you know, suspicion to deportation to executions. Your political stance is assumed to be flowing from your ethnic belonging.
So let's talk a little more about anti-German sentiment. How widespread was it, say, in 1915?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anti-German sentiment really develops. Well, it has a history already before the war. The German communities in the Russian Empire, many of them were, they retained their Germanness. They lived in their own villages, and they were often quite prosperous. They're stretched out across the Volga River. There's many of them in Ukraine. And also there are many German businessmen basically in the big cities who control a lot of finance and control a lot of manufacturing, honestly, in the big cities in the Russian Empire too. So there's already sort of this potential for social antagonism by ethnic Russians who say, why are these guys making all the money in our country when we're not able to? Why are they dominating us? This is the propaganda theme is German dominance. How do we undo German dominance in our country? And this is going to get linked, as I said before, to Alexandra eventually, because of her German upbringing. But it has its roots much, much deeper in these social antagonisms. Now, when war gets declared and you have a massive propaganda campaign unleashed all across Europe to sort of demonize your enemies, the same thing happens in Russia. And there are good reasons why anti-Germanism is going to spread quite quickly in the borderlands. The Germans do come in, and in a couple of notorious incidents, as they had in Belgium, they raise towns, they execute civilians, they do a lot of brutal things. And this leads to rumors of German bestiality, basically, spreading throughout the big cities in the empire, too. This is going to culminate at the very beginning of the big Russian defeats in 1915. In a series of pogroms in Moscow in particular, in which not only German, but virtually all or many foreign stores are attacked as part of by popular mobs and looted by virtue of being German. And the state then moves to also sequester this property or seize land and factories and such from German speakers and especially from people who remain German citizens.
Mm. 1915 is also when we see a retreat from Poland by the Russian military. Can you talk a little bit about that? And who was taking responsibility for strategic decisions during 1915?
Yeah, so when the war begins, Nicholas considers briefly going to the front as commander-in-chief himself. There had been a long tradition of thinking about the autocrat as the military leader of the country. But there was also a tradition, most notably in the Napoleonic Wars, of delegating most of the command authority or nearly all the command authority to professional generals. And so he's persuaded at that point to appoint a commander-in-chief. He appoints his relative, the Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolaevich, who had a military career, who then assembles a staff, most notably his chief of staff, a guy named General Januszkiewicz. And they are the head of the so-called Stavka or Supreme Headquarters, but there's significant There's significant influence also for front commanders and individual army commanders. It's a huge army, and each front has several armies under it, and then each of those commanders are also going to have are going to have significant authority. But ultimately, it's going to be Grand Duke Nikolaevich and his chief of staff Yanushkevich. This retreat happened. I mean, and much of the reason for this retreat has to do with mismanagement on the part of General Headquarters. It begins near the sort of the north end of the Carpathian Mountains, near the Polish towns of Gorlice and Tarnów. But then it's going to spread all the way first, actually, kind of through Ukraine before you have the big blow onto sort of Congress Poland or the Russian Kingdom of Poland later on in the summer of 1915. And the basic problem is they're not able to mobilize reserves to patch the holes in the line that get blown apart in a couple of these battles. This is a consistent problem in World War I for all armies, which is that most of them believe that you have to gather these enormous amounts of shells and break a hole in the enemy's line and then break through and force a retreat that way. But the problem is once you consolidate all of that, they can see you doing that. And when you start bombarding, they know where you're going to hit it and they retreat from it. And then you break through the lines and then the reserves come up to push you back. So it's quite frequently the case, actually, on all fronts that the first line of trenches is taken by enemies. This notion that they never get across no man's land is simply not true. But the problem is that reserves are usually deployed with sufficient skill that you're unable to develop that breakthrough into something more strategically meaningful. And the difference in 1915 is that the Russians mismanage those reserves and they are able to achieve this breakthrough. And once you have this breakthrough, you know, once you get behind the lines, it forces a retreat all across the lines so that people don't get pinned in between two forces. So most of the retreat happens, not because you're being fought from the troops that are facing you, but you're worried about troops coming into the back of you, and so you have to flee backwards. And then you get harassed and chased as you're being driven back. And this gets called the Great Retreat in Russia. They basically abandon all of Poland, much of Ukraine, much of Lithuania, much of Belarus. It's an enormous retreat. It's the most significant offensive in the European theater, really throughout the war. I mean, you can make a case for 1918 and what happens on the Western Front, but that actually is less territory than you're seeing here in 1915.
You write that this is also the real fracture of the imperial political system that occurs during the summer of 1915. What were those events that, you know, so if 1905 is when that mass politics, that switch is flipped, mm-hmm. but here's where we see the real fracture of empire. What was it that happened here? Yeah.
So in 1914, when the war is declared, there's an agreement made by virtually all political parties, excluding the far, far left, like the Bolsheviks. Excluding them, but virtually everyone else enter what they call a sacred union. They say, okay, we're going to quit politics. We're going to disband the Duma. We're going to let the Tsarist government run the war, and we'll get back to our political questions when the fighting's done. But we're going to let the Tsar fight and run this war effort and his administration fight and run the war effort. In the space of less than a year, they've run it into the ground. There are massive problems with supplies. There's massive problems with treating wounded soldiers. You have this huge retreat. You have the encirclement of the Second Army in 1914 and the suicide of its commander. I mean, it's just a disaster. The Tsarist administration has demonstrated that it's incapable of effectively running this war effort. And that's... that problem means the end of the sacred union. People, as patriots, have to say, look, we can't just sit here and watch this happen anymore. We have to get involved. We have to do something. And they do this in a wide variety of ways, from forming, sort of relief agencies to building hospitals to a wide variety of ways. But they also do it politically. They start to say, okay, we need to get more involved politically. We have to have discussions between the Tsar and his administration and these other public figures, especially those prominent figures, centrist figures in the Duma, who can bring the country along and we can maybe start to repair some of the damage that's done. And so this is the movement that happens over the course of the summer. At the same time, you're starting to see a reinvigoration of the strike wave. Strikes had basically ceased in 1914. Labor unrest had basically ceased, but now in 1915, you're starting to see a number of big strikes again. Many of them are being shot at by policemen. So you're starting to see that social unrest building again. And you get what gets called the progressive bloc that is supposed to sort of help the Tsarist administration sort of jointly now run the war effort. And what happens in 1915 is this progressive bloc gets built from, again, on a spectrum from the left to the conservative right. And they say, okay, we're going to do this. And at the last minute, the Tsar backs out and says, no, this is an abrogation of constitutional power. I'm going to disband the Duma. I'm going to fire most of my ministers and I'm going to run this war effort and I'm going to go to the front personally to do it. So he completely rejects this political effort to work together. And now the people on the outside are left basically saying, okay, what can we do to try to save our country? And that's the story of the next sort of year and a half is, you know, how do they continue to try to run the government? How do they continue to try to help refugees while at the same time saying, look, we're not going to solve this problem until we get rid of the autocracy.
And it's in October of 1915, after all of these events, that Nicholas writes to Stanley Washburn, we have no public opinion in Russia. And you've already talked a little bit about his kind of rejection of ground up politics and the way that he thinks politics should run. But you know, so I've asked you here to describe what he meant by that, but you've kind of already given us a picture. Maybe instead, how could he still think this? Like after this summer, after so much clear popular opposition, whether it's strikers, whether it's, you know, political parties opposing him and his rule, how can he still think this way?
Yeah, I mean, the capacity for self-deception among humans is quite high. You know, it's... And this, again, he's for him to recognize that politics in Russia was modern politics, that you do have things like coalescing public opinion, that you do have pressure groups, that you do have constituencies rather than a passive population that you run by divine right is fundamentally something that if he were to accept that, it would mean he would have to accept that he's not a legitimate Tsar. He's not a legitimate leader. And he's unwilling to do that. And he doesn't understand it, right? Earlier in this conversation with Washburn, Washburn is expressing his regret over American politics. And he says, Nicholas sort of blinks and looks at him, says, I don't understand anything about your politics. Like he doesn't understand how electoral politics really work, even though he's had the Duma over the last, you know, he doesn't understand about sort of why Wilson is in trouble or not in trouble. Like all of that stuff is just, he just says, I don't understand it. It's not the way that, that he thinks about politics. So, and that's what he means by no public opinion. It's not that people don't have opinions. He knows people have opinions, but that there's no consolidation of this in a way that would represent the national will, right? That's what public opinion really means. And this is the distinction that begins to happen is that the Tsar believes that he, by definition, represents the nation. And what's happening over the course of the war is that Russians are understanding, no, our national interest, our national identity, our national community is defined by us. It's not defined by the Tsar. And in fact, the Tsar is alien to that and working against its best interests. And when that finally gets realized, that, of course, makes it untenable for the Tsar to continue.
So you say Nicholas disbands the Duma at the time. This wasn't the first time, right? How is Nicholas thinking about the Duma, relating to it? If he's saying, well, there's no public opinion. He also, kind of functionally says, well, there's no Duma either. I'm just going to run this war. Can you say a little bit more about how Nicholas dealt with the Duma and political functionaries below him?
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, the way he does it is by having his prime minister deal with it and his other ministers deal with it. He doesn't want to appear before the Duma. When he does, he normally insults them and there's sort of bad relations. And so he wants to have as little to do with them as possible. Even the ones, the centrist ones, guys like Alexander Guchkov, who are basically working to try to stabilize the system. He dislikes them personally. He doesn't want to have anything really to do with them. And so he kind of insists that his ministers do that work. And that's one of the problems in 1915 is that the ministers have done that work and all but one of them basically agrees that, we have to work together with them. And so 1916, the Duma is going to meet a couple more times briefly early in the year, and then in a very explosive session late in the year, in November leading up to December, they're going to sort of force their way back onto the agenda. Nicholas contents himself with thinking, okay, well, I'm going to be at the front. He's actually not doing a lot of the military leadership at that point. That's his chief of staff, a guy named Mikhail Alexeyev, who's doing most of that work. And frankly, most of the political work in the country is being done outside of the formal government itself. That is to say, if you're asking who's providing food to refugees, who's building hospitals for soldiers, it's actually not the government anymore. It's these public organizations that are doing a lot of this work. And so politics has moved out of the state and into these sort of parastatal organizations.
You write that one concrete outcome of the offensives of 1916 mm-hmm. was that progressive projects for social renovation and mobilization could be married to political demands for dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say a few more words on that?
Yeah. There's this, what I'm trying to describe in that chapter is the development of a kind of technocratic progressivism. That is to say, this is not that progressivism defined by expertise, that you're going to achieve progressive goals by having experts determine how to run an education system or healthcare system or military system for that matter, right? So you don't need necessarily to deal with the messy politics of mass politics and elections and all those sorts of things. And so you're seeing these efforts to say, okay, we know best how to fix this war effort because we're experts, we're government experts, we're scientists, we're whatever. And these movements to try to fix the war through this sort of progressive technocratic lens lends itself in a certain way towards saying, okay, well, let's think about how we would run the government in wartime. And this is definitely not the majority view. I think most progressives want to see something much more democratic, frankly, than the autocracy or military dictatorship would be. But within the military itself, and within Alexeyev himself as the chief of staff, the notion that look, all of the Tsar's family, they're causing all these problems, so much sort of confusion, all of these sort of groups running around. We're not coordinating them well. We're wasting a lot of money. If we just have a military dictatorship that is able to consolidate the war effort, then we're going to be able to win the war, and then we can figure out the politics later. And so that's, again, sort of thinking about it in terms of that competence. Now, this is an assumption of military competence that is not borne out. Right? One of the points I try to make in the book is that throughout, the military keeps saying, oh, we know best how to do this. If we run it, it's going to be orderly because we're the military. Things will be orderly. In fact, when the military takes over these state functions, they do a really bad job of it, and it leads to chaos in many places. So this automatic assumption that the military means order, which is widespread not only in Russia, but obviously around the world, is sort of a dominant feature of the way that the military perceives itself, turns out not to be the case many times on the ground. And so, I think a military dictatorship would have been quite disastrous. There was already kind of a military dictatorship in the frontline zones. And I described throughout the book about the problems that emerged there.
So you write that on the surface, the period between the Great Retreat and the revolutionary crisis of 1917 was marked by stasis. But how would you sketch out the important changes occurring in Russian society while attention was focused on Rasputin, the chaotic roulette of ministerial appointments he inspired in Petrograd, kind of palace intrigue and suspicion of Germans? What was actually happening while the kind of intrigue was taking the focus?
Yeah. A number of things are making the lived experience of people in the empire much worse. So if you're in the front line or near the front line, you're experiencing a lot of personal insecurity in terms of violence. You're starting to see a breakdown of social order in many of these places, led in many cases by deserting or off-duty soldiers. But even far away from the front, one of the key things that happens over the course of the war is a worsening standard of living driven by rapid inflation. This is a problem that the Tsarist government can't get around. It mismanages its monetary policy, but it also just fails to come to terms with the big changes in supply and demand for various things in the empire over the course of the war. Plus, they attack many of the merchants and arrest them, right? Because they're suspicious of merchants and especially of Jewish merchants. And so, all of this leads to on the one hand, inflation, and on the other hand, goods shortages. And so you're starting to see, especially by the time we get to the turn of the year into 1917, bread lines, the discussion of the need for rationing. You're starting to see the supply situation deteriorate in terms of trains being able to ship what they need to on time. All of these things are beginning to deteriorate. And social relations are also becoming more and more poisonous. Ethnopolitics has done its role there. This wide sort of influx of refugees and the difficulties of dealing with them has helped poison the social relationships. And above all, this feeling that the rich are doing okay in this war and the rest of us are bearing this burden and look at how badly they're managing it. This is becoming more and more dominant among all sectors of society. And so, kind of who Rasputin thinks should be the minister of Minister of Interior, let's say, that doesn't have a huge bearing on people's lives. They're seeing things just collapsing, and it's not the result of a particular minister or anything. It's the whole structure. It's autocracy itself that has led them into this problem.
Can you describe the class dimensions of women serving as Sisters of Mercy mm-hmm. during the war? And we'll talk a little bit more about dealing with the wounded and how mm-hmm. significant the casualties were.
Yeah.
But let's start with Sisters of Mercy. Who were they? And you write really meaningfully about the class dimensions mm-hmm. of service.
Yeah, so women are looking to get involved in the war quite early and many of them quite earnestly throughout the war. And, there are a number of good recent studies of nurses during the war, most notably by Laurie Stoff, who has done the most extensive work on them. And so you do end up getting people from a range of backgrounds serving in medical services, women throughout the war. But at first, there's this expectation that you want to get aristocratic women to do it, that you want to get sort of well-behaved, well-born women to do this dirty work with wounded and naked men, frankly, right? And this notion that that you had to have a certain sort of social background in order to achieve this well was prominent. Early in the war, for the Red Cross more than that necessarily than for Sisters of Mercy more broadly. But that's going over the course of the war, they're going to expand as the demand grows. It's going to expand more and more. And so that question of the social background of these women that is not quite so clear of a class divide.
Mm. In the first 2 years of the war, more than 2.8 million men are wounded on the Russian side. 2.5 million of them require hospitalization. You've already talked a little bit about hospitals and who was building them. Mm-hmm. And you write that the planned capacity of the medical response fell far short and the realities fell even below the plans. Mm-hmm. Can you just say a little bit more about how failures to treat the wounded contributed to political opposition to Tsarist rule?
Yeah, and this was enormously widespread. What happens at the beginning of the war, the scale of casualties surprises everyone. It shouldn't have surprised the Russians as much as it did. There were quite large casualties in the Russian Russo-Japanese War. They knew what industrialized warfare could do, but still, it was at a scale that that they should have planned for more. But the fact was that again, the Tsarist administration was incapable of getting the job done. The structure didn't allow them to do it. The finances didn't allow them to do it. And as a result, they just didn't have hospital beds at the beginning of the war. You had trains filled with wounded and dying men that were going nowhere, basically. There was no place for them to unload their human cargoes. And this creates an immediate crisis. And, up to the very highest levels, the royal family itself is besieged with complaints by, aristocratic kids are dying in these train cars too. It's not just lower class people. And so people are complaining quite vociferously quite early, and they still can't quite get it together. And this is when you get this public effort by the Union of Towns and Union of Cities. These are, again, sort of public organizations. Think about them maybe as sort of NGOs or charitable organizations, something like that. They're the ones that run these fund drives. They have these, they go around and people collect money to build a hospital, and they're the ones that generate all these extra beds and indeed these extra hospital trains. And that's one of the things that gives them sort of prestige moving forward. And indeed, the very first sort of head of the provisional government after the Tsar abdicates is the head of this Union of Towns and Cities because he has this political weight as a result of these efforts during the war.
You've already said a little bit about food scarcity, food supply, bread lines, and how that kind of put pressure on the Tsarist government. So we can kind of step mm-hmm. by that. But would you briefly sketch for us the events that finally did lead the Tsar to step down?
Yeah. This is the so-called February Revolution. You know, as folks probably know, the calendar in Russia was different up until 1918. So many of these famous revolutionary days actually take place in different months now. But in any case, it begins on International Women's Day, which was a relatively new socialist holiday instituted in as a result of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City, again, driven by socialist parties and by labor movements as a way to sort of recognize women within the socialist movement. And so International Women's Day provides the opportunity for many women across the city of Petrograd to go out on marches. And what they want to protest at this point is a series of things. The war, the Tsarist administration, and the fact that their lives have now been taken over by increasingly long bread lines. Many of them are having to wake up in the pre-dawn hours to stand in line to maybe get a loaf of bread, and then going off to a 10-hour shift, and then bringing that loaf of bread home to their kids when maybe their husband is also working, or their husband is off at the war, and this has become a completely untenable situation, and they're putting the blame for this where it actually belongs, on the Tsar and on the war itself. They're not wrong about who has led them to this situation. And so you actually have marches of working class women in the working class districts. You have marches of middle class women in the more middle class districts of the city. But it's the one in the working class districts that gets the most weight, because they ask big groups of workers from defense factories to join them. And when the defense factories also go out on strike and join them, it becomes a crisis for the police in Petrograd. They attempt to deal with this by blocking off bridges, by doing a series of other things. They shoot into the crowd at several moments, but then they feel that they have to call in the army. The army has several barracks in the city, and they have to call those soldiers up to help them police the city. And when they do that, it turns out that the soldiers are on the side of the protesters. You have mass mutinies among the soldiers in the Petrograd garrison. They drive the police away. The police throw away their uniforms. They flee on trains. They hide. They break open the jails. They start burning court records. All this stuff is happening. The Tsar orders troops to be sent from the front to put down the rebellion in the city. The first groups of those, when they arrive in the outskirts, the commanders quickly realize that if they send troops into the city, those troops are also going to rebel, and then they're going to have a real problem on their hands. So they start to withdraw. And when they withdraw from those suburbs, the high command, the Tsar is also coming back to this suburb town where his family is living, Tsarskoye Selo, they put his train on a siding in a city called Pskov, and they convince him that he has to abdicate. So it's at the final end of the day, it's his generals that tell him he can no longer continue, and that he has to find some, and they have to find a way forward to fight the war to a victorious conclusion without him. They think about abdicating in favor of his sickly son. That turns out not to be feasible. Then in favor of his brother, who wisely says, this is not a job I particularly want at this moment. And so at the end of the day, he abdicates in favor of no one. And there, you know, in an autocratic system, there's no system in place to sort of ensure that a non-monarch takes place. The only group that has been elected nationwide at that point is the Duma, and they form what they call a provisional committee and eventually a provisional government that says, okay, we're gonna hold power until we can have a constituent assembly, that is to say, kind of a constitutional convention. Maybe we should wait to do that till the end of the war. Things are kind of crazy right now. Let's not have a constitutional convention. And that sets up the dynamic for 1917, where you have this provisional government without any legitimacy now having to deal with this massive wave of political demands from all sides.
Right. And instead of ending conflict, you know, rather than bringing stability, the following years see revolution, a protracted civil war. But I think we'll cover those just kind of in the script. I'd like to get to the questions and have you speak on them. So, would you describe why and how the Eastern Front and the really significant events we've been talking about today, write about, why have they been overlooked in histories of the Great War of World War One?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, you know, we're talking largely about English speaking audiences here, and there weren't many English speakers fighting there. And, you know, there's an element of that sort of parochialism that's always going to slip in. There's a desire to see where your boys were fighting as the most important places. And that's true both of World War One and of World War Two, where, you know, where English speakers aren't fighting, those are seen as not as consequential when, in many cases they are. So that's one reason, probably the largest reason why it's not known as well. There are no victors to write this war story on the Eastern Front. All the empires lose. All of the German Empire, the Russian Empire, Ottoman Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire. There's no victors to write this history. And indeed, in many of these places, the system is hostile to the regime that preceded it. Most notably, in the Russian Empire, right? They don't want to tell a heroic tale of what happened in World War One, and it wasn't a particularly heroic tale. So it's not that hard for them not to have to do it. So, and they do have this heroic moment of the revolution that they can talk about. And so in Russia, the focus is going to be on the revolution. In Britain and America, it's going to be on and France, obviously, it's going to be on the Western Front. And as a result, the Eastern Front has traditionally been talked about less, especially by English-speaking audiences. And that's too bad, because as I tried to articulate in the beginning of the book, I think it's not just sort of another theater. I think we see something really important happening here on the Eastern Front, which is this process of European decolonization, which you're not seeing on the Western Front, and which which is very, very prominent as we see the rise of not only of social revolution, but also of nationalist independent movements, and more generally of decentralizing movements, of efforts to think about, let's say, what a federal state might look like, or these other ways of thinking about a world after empire. And so all of those things make the Eastern Front, you know, really, really important.
Do you think that the fall of Imperial Russia and this breakdown of empire was inevitable in some meaningful sense, or is there a better way of thinking and talking about what happened?
Yeah, this is a longstanding debate within the field of Russian history. That is to say, did the war delay revolution? This is one argument, is that revolution was about to happen in 1914 and it delayed it by a few years, or did it accelerate, revolution and the end of the empire? I tend not to be a historian that thinks in terms of inevitability very much. It's not a very persuasive way for me to think about this, but it's, you know, the question of sort of likely outcomes I've thought about quite a bit. And, you know, once the war happens, I think there are a relatively small set of likely outcomes. I think it's quite unlikely that the Tsarist regime is going to preserve itself in a sort of non-constitutional monarch form. That is to say, it's not going to go back to the way it was. I think too much will have changed over the course of that. Even if, let's say, no February Revolution happens, let's say the Germans decide to sign a negotiated peace in early 1917, I don't think you're going to go back to the status quo ante. I think the most likely outcome is the one that happens throughout Eastern Europe after the war, which is a military dictatorship of some kind, a right-wing military dictatorship of some kind. That seems to be the most likely outcome, and it very nearly happened in Russia as well. And in Russia, what you end up having is a left-wing military dictatorship along with a revolutionary program, and that was obviously not inevitable, and it certainly wasn't likely. I don't know where you'd put the number at. 10%, 25%. The Bolsheviks hit their number. Sometimes it happens in history that a non-probable thing happens, and I think that's what happens. A number of things have to go quite right for the Bolsheviks to seize power over the course of 1917. But again, I don't think that sort of, I don't see sort of an autocracy surviving into the 21st century. You know, if and, you know, you can see something like the British monarchy, although it too is in trouble right now. But, you know, you can see something like the British monarchy, you know, that kind of system. But that would be so completely different from what was present in Russia at the beginning of the 20th century. It's not really the same thing.
Mm. Yeah. And then finally, taking some of what you've written and thinking about some of the people we're going to be talking about with this season of Unobscured in our program, you've written that state failure does not need to be brought on by anti-imperial revolutionaries. Imperial states can self-destruct, mm-hmm. either knowingly or unintentionally. And in popular history, a lot of times, because the focus is on the person of Nicholas or Alexandra or Rasputin, the collapse of Imperial Russia is credited to their personal actions, their personal limitations, blind spots, that kind of thing. So to what extent do you think any one of these people were directly responsible for the end of Tsarist rule?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, when I wrote that line, I guess I have two quick answers to that. So when I wrote that line, what I was thinking about actually was the institution of martial law at the beginning of the war, which I think breaks the back of imperial governance in the borderlands. So that's what the first couple chapters of the book are about. What happens when you take these experienced imperial administrators and you remove them, or they remove themselves, they flee in many cases, and you replace them with completely inept, basically, military officers to try to govern these territories. And what you end up with is economic disaster, ethnic deportations. You get a whole series of really terrible things that undermines society and state in these regions. So that's the process of imperial self-destruction I'm talking about. This sort of modus vivendi, even if it was an unpleasant one for Poles and Ukrainians, they were prepared to live with it for the long term. Many of them were talking about living with it for the long term in 1913. And that was no longer the case by the time we get to 1915. And that's largely the result of a series of really bad mistakes that are driven from above. Now, Nicholas makes those decisions. He's not the only one making those decisions about martial law, for instance. Now, the question of sort of how important the royal family and Rasputin is, I don't see that. I mean, they certainly have importance. That is to say that Nicholas, at the end of the day, does make these decisions. And the decisions he makes quite frequently are ones that are going to lead them down the road to disaster. A better monarch, a monarch that, let's say, had if Stolypin isn't assassinated or Vita isn't, you know, you can think of a series of quite talented Russian politicians who might have helped prevent this this situation from getting to where it did. Nicholas is responsible for not allowing that to happen, for not promoting that from happening. I think the sort of the criticism of Alexandra and then by extension Rasputin, a lot of it is wrapped up in quite I don't know the best way to put it. I mean, a lot of it is wrapped up, obviously, in anti-Germanism. A lot of it is wrapped up in sexism, obviously. You know, that's a lot of the criticism that's happening for them. But it also doesn't reflect the fact that I talked about before, which is that the decisions they're making in 1916, after Nicholas leaves for the front in 1916, let's say, they're not that consequential. I don't think it actually matters that much who the Minister of Interior or Minister of Communications is, right? I just don't think it matters too much. Most of the actual work that's being done is being done by people that they don't have control over, especially in the military. And so, you know, I don't see them as that important. Now, in terms of the loss of public faith on the part of the Petersburg elite, which is something important, the faith of your political elite is something important in a political system. It's obvious that they have an effect on that. So for sure, they have an influence on that. And that's why that's why it's conservatives and ultra-right-wing people that assassinate Rasputin, right, is because they're the ones that are most affected by this, right? It's not left-wing terrorists that assassinate Rasputin, right? He's irrelevant to them, you know? It's the right-wing and the political elite that is most consumed by him. But to take a brief counterfactual maybe, if Rasputin never existed, does the Russian Empire collapse as it does? And I think yes. I don't think even the timing is shifted by that. So it's hard for me to see that he has sort of a large macro effect, even if his micro effect on the way that people discuss the revolution and the collapse of the empire is quite large, both at the time and then afterwards, because he's an interesting, salacious and controversial figure. It's understandable why people want to read about him, want to talk about him, both at the time and now.
Beautiful. That's great. That lines right up with the thesis statement.
All right, good. Good.
Yeah, so that's what I have for us. And I do want to be respectful of your time and letting you get out of here. But
terrific. This has been a lot of fun.
That's it for this week's episode of Unobscured. Stick around after this short sponsor break for a preview of what's in store for next week.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When I went away and looked and honed in and focused on the very end of their lives, i.e. pretty much from when they were imprisoned at the Alexander Palace, and then I honed it in even closer to the last 2 weeks of their lives in Ekaterinburg in the Ipatiev House, I suddenly realized there was a really interesting and exciting scenario there that had never been explored, which was looking at the family really close up. How were they? What was going through their minds? How did they deal with captivity? What were the tensions being trapped in a house in Western Siberia, knowing that probably the writing was on the wall?
Unobscured was created by me, Aaron Mankey, and produced by Matt Frederick, Alex Williams, and Josh Thane in partnership with iHeartRadio. With research by Sam Alberti, writing by Carl Nellis, and original music by Chad Lawson. Learn more about our contributing historians, source materials, and links to our other shows over at grimandmild.com/unobscured. And as always, thanks for listening.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.